Hello, Solaris subscribers. Here we are once again with the Omnivore's friend, Bill Nyman. And we're going to complete our series of three with the animal category groups, poultry and sheep. Hello, Bill.
Hi, Harry. It's good to be with you again.
So do you know anything about poultry? Have you had any experience with it?
A little bit, and I'm gaining more quickly. So I'm actually quite focused right now on poultry. It's my second favorite endeavor on the farm.
You were quite involved with what you might call heirloom turkeys, right? Weren't you for a while?
Well, I don't like the term heirloom. Now, that's a term that's being used to purposefully confuse consumers. So what I'm involved with is heritage turkeys, which are the old breeds. And in the eating experience, and one might think they're a completely different species. But heirloom is really a modern white bird crossed with a heritage bird to give it colored feathers. So it's a modern bird with dark feathers. It's a small percentage of heritage breeding. And it's people feel good about buying it and think they're supporting, you know, heritage genetics, and they aren't really doing that.
Okay, so that's very, very significant here. So because most people think of heirloom as kind of those original seeds and those original breeds like the heritage. And what you're saying is it's actually a technical term that's used by the industry that refers to something quite different.
Yes. The heirloom and heritage are quite different, but the consumers are confused. I think they're the same, as you stated.
So like if I was buying an heirloom tomato versus a heritage tomato, that has meaning in the tomato field, right? Heirloom tomatoes?
Yes, to the best of my knowledge. I'm not that familiar with it, but it's not an analogous situation to the heirloom turkey or heirloom chicken.
Okay, so that's a very, very significant point right off the bat. So tell us about those heritage breeds and why they are such a different experience, eating experience, and also your experience with them.
Yeah. Well, actually, 11 years ago, I remember it well, Nicola, and I thought, well, what are we going to do on our farm in addition to our grass-based cattle and beef cattle? And we thought that the opportunity for us, both from a operational point of view on the farm, as well as something that we had begun to see growing interest in the marketplace in our, you know, our Northern California market, would be heritage turkeys, old breeds of turkeys. And we just happened to know we knew the guy well, who was really the kind of the keeper of the genetics and the still kind of the standard bearer for heritage breed of turkeys, a guy named Frank Reese in Lindsborg, Kansas. So we determined that would be a good fit for our farm, and we wanted to try it out. And we called Frank and said, Frank, we'd like to get some of your turkeys. Would you be willing to sell us some day-olds? And he said, yeah, but you have to come and get them. So we literally rented a car, drove to Kansas, and came back with about 300 little turkeys chirping in the back seat of our car. We watched them hatch, loaded them up in the car in carrying containers, proper containers, and headed for California. And that was the genesis of BN Ranch Heritage Turkeys, which we think are probably the best in the country from an eating point of view. They certainly were, as evidenced by many side-by-sides and very well-trained palates, well-tuned palates, critiquing the eating experience. Now, one thing that was appealing to us also is that heritage turkeys can actually survive outdoors. They breed naturally. They can fly. So they exhibit all the characteristics of their ancestors and the original turkeys. And for those who are living in areas where wild turkeys frequent, they are remarkably similar in appearance, albeit the heritage breeds that are being raised for human consumption as opposed to wild ones have been, you know, selected for their ability to get a little fatter and develop a little more breast meat and a little more muscle as opposed to being wily and survival in their own in the wild. So
But doesn't the meat tend to be a little bit darker?
It does.
And, you know, the butterball.
Yeah, that, it's antithetical to that in terms of color. But what's really interesting about the meat quality, even the white part, that the front of the bird is usually described as the white part. That would include the breast. The back would be the leg and thigh. But even the white meat or the whiter meat on the heritage birds has the eating characteristics of dark meat. So it's so wonderfully different. It's both succulent because they store intermuscular fat and because they need to survive in the winter, and they know that. It's still, that hasn't been bred out of them. And it's, you know, it's like the difference between lean beef and well marbled beef. So it's really, and in terms of flavor, I can't imagine why anybody would want to eat white meat. But if you are a white meat lover, you're going to really, really enjoy the white meat on heritage breeds because it has the wonderful flavor characteristics, but not excessive as dark meat does.
And are there some heritage breeds that you have found are just better producers or better tasting? Which ones do you like the most?
Well, we originally had five different breeds, and we did some taste tests, although the sample was maybe not statistically valid, but we didn't notice any flavor difference. We currently breed three different breeds, three of maybe 10 breeds that are out there. And that was more driven by consumer preferences in terms of size and finish. So we like not the huge birds, but not the small ones either. So it seems like the magic number is either 8 to 12 pounds, which is a female, or, you know, 18 to 22 pounds, which is a male.
Can you tell any difference in the eating experience between the two?
Well, my preference is for the smaller birds, but the reason for that is I like to have the dark meat, the leg and thigh. So if you have two small birds, everybody gets a piece of the thigh or the leg, and then people are happy. So it's driven really by the ritual and the ceremony at the table more than actual eating quality differences.
Also, you don't look like Cro-Magnon man when you have this huge, leg in your
mouth.
That's
correct.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, and you don't have to, you know, no hands. Yeah. But the other side of that is that in all animals raised for food, the females tend to mature and fatten sooner. One, because they don't grow as much, they don't get as big, and two, as in all mammals as well as poultry, the females tend to mature more quickly than the males. So maturity is about flavor, and it's also about stopping the growth of bone and muscle and metabolizing what they eat into fat and storing that intermuscularly or thoracic cavities.
And if you're knocking out eggs pretty regularly and you have to, produce little chicks, it probably helps to have a nice store of fat.
That's a store of all nutrients and all important building blocks. It's a very difficult task. It takes a lot out of the hens to lay eggs. So it may be a different nutritional requirement than it does to make good flesh, but they need to be fully loaded.
You mentioned that you use three of 10 breeds. Are you saying that today there's only really 10 heritage breeds? And how does that compare with, 100 or 200 years ago?
Yeah. I just picked that number out. It could be 12, it could be 8. But I imagine that there's some very rare breeds that would increase that number. Well, as in all poultry, there were lots of breeds and lots of backyard farmers in urban situations or urban fringe. And I think every family farm raised a flock of birds and took some to market and ate some themselves and had a bunch of laying hens and sold eggs alongside the road or to their neighbors. So that was because it was so disparate. There are so many different areas, locations, and breed preferences based on perhaps irrational things, just like the color of their feathers as opposed to how many eggs they laid. And I think everybody who's thought about chickens and done any research has seen the myriad of different breeds and their characteristics and they're not quite as different as dogs are, you know, between a Chihuahua and a Great Dane, but there's an incredible amount of variation in poultry, all poultry, whether it's ducks, geese, chickens, turkeys. But I believe that chickens probably would trump all others for the number of breeds, and then turkeys would be close behind that.
Although in the chicken world, we end up with very few breeds and for commercial production, right?
Yeah, well, that is true for turkeys as well. I mean, there are some people that are raising heritage chickens and heritage turkeys, but in terms of percentage of the entire national flock, I mean, it wouldn't even register, you know.
But the point is, for the commercial purposes, what are the breeds, primary breeds that they use for chicken and for turkey in the commercial world?
Well, the most prevalent white broiler is the Cobb. There's three companies that control the genetics and sell eggs or newborn chicks to the industry. And, you know, one of them is owned by Tyson, which is called Cobb. It's a separate, wholly independent division of Tyson. And then Aviagen, and the third one escapes me, O'Hubbard. So these are the three companies throughout the world that control all the modern genetics, and which are ubiquitous. And wherever you go in the world in poultry operations, you'll see the same genetics. And although there's some variation in different strains, to a lay person or even a casual farmer, chicken farmer, they all look the same.
So we have huge vulnerability in the food system because we have almost no diversity in that area, right?
Yeah. There could be a system failure, a system collapse, and which would not be surprising. Now, fortunately, there are enough people that are maintaining the older breeds, either just because they're passionate about it or they believe that it is a better eating experience and they're adapted better to their environment wherever they are. And so there's probably enough genetic diversity still out there that we could maybe reinvigorate the chicken flocks around the world. But it would be a monumental undertaking.
And what is the primary commercial breed for turkeys?
It's the same breeders, Aviagen and Hubbard, and they have numbers. And I actually don't know the answer to that, but the Nicholas White Bird was the first one that was developed in Northern California. And that's a really fast-growing bird with a large breast that converts feed to meat and bone, muscle and bone, very efficiently. And that particular turkey dominates the entire world of turkey. And it's a key ancestor to every modern white turkey on the planet, really.
But now the modern white turkeys have numbers, not even names. That's beautiful.
Yeah, well, the Cobb 500 is the other one. You know, that's the chicken, the broiler. So,
and then so hear, what? Go ahead.
Then you hear about Cobb crosses. You know, so there's a little bit of crossing with other modern white birds, but these are birds that, excuse me, are, you know, ready to eat. They live for 42 to 49 days, and they grow very fast. They grow so fast that their bones can't support the obscene breast meat. You know, they can't breed naturally. They can't fly. So we've really created something that in nature could not survive.
And that's a turkey. You're talking about the turkey.
Turkey,
the
and
modern turkey.
The chicken is the same. It's a chicken and turkey. That's an interchangeable description of the modern white broiler chicken and the modern white turkey.
And are you saying that both of them mature in that period of time, 42 to 49 days?
The chickens are 42 to 49 days, mostly 42 and 43. That's the economic imperative to get them to town by that age. Because so much of the cost of raising the feed and every day, you know, reduces the margin. Turkeys are about 10 weeks for the modern turkeys as they get much larger and heavier. And for a heritage turkey, it's 26 to 28 weeks. So it's more than twice the time to get to this equal weight.
And how about for a heritage chicken, if you really want
to... The same. I believe there's more variation in the growth rates on heritage chicken, primarily because there's been a lot of momentum and a lot of people focusing on how can we get the hardiness of a heritage chicken and the flavor of a heritage chicken, but have it grow fast. And also, the current movement in the chicken world in terms of how can we make a better chicken, and the focus has shifted from antibiotic-free and hormone-free and GMO-free to slower growing because the birds suffer so much from the growth rate, growing so fast that their bones cannot support their weight and they're living in pain from the last 10, 15 days of their lives. And the animal welfare community and the consumers are now becoming aware of that. And you'll begin to see people announcing that by the year 2090, we're going to only have slower growing birds, right? So, you know, some people are more ambitious. So by the year 2020, all of our chicken will be slower growing. And that's the kind of the key paradigm shift in the consumer and in the marketing of people who are active in the chicken world.
And slower growing is how many days compared to the 42, 43 typical for commercial?
Well, they're going from extending the growth rate from 7 weeks to maybe 10 weeks at the outside. But ideally, they'd like to have a bird grow in 7 weeks but not suffer the way the birds that are growing in 7 weeks today. So the chicken world is doing everything they can to get the performance they can get in 42 days in these modern white birds as close to that 42 days as possible by introducing some heritage genetics as a crossbreed or seeking that golden goose, which would be a pure heritage bird that could reach maturity in, you know, 6 or 8 weeks.
Well, maybe we could tie some balloons to them, so, you know, give them some support so they don't collapse and they could grow real fast.
Yeah, the helium, that would be great. Okay.
So are you saying that heritage chickens are also typically raised to 26, 28 weeks, like turkeys?
No. The heritage chickens are 12 to 20 weeks. There are some, you know, it's a pretty broad, a long continuum. There's some that go, you know, 10 to 12 weeks or even up to 20 weeks. You know, they get bigger and they have different eating characteristics. But the consumer has been so conditioned to having a soft, mushy, white breast that as soon as they eat something that has texture and a little bit of pushback, a little bit of chew, even though greatly flavored, they don't. It's not the way it's supposed to be. So the industry has done a great job of convincing people that chicken should be not have very much flavor and should be mushy and soft.
And part of that mush is the water content too, right? Because the USDA allows them to have quite a bit of water content in them after slaughter and when it hits the market, right?
Well, yes. What happens is most chickens, unless they're clearly identified as air chilled, are chilled in water. Some are chilled in ice, but most of the birds are in the marketplace, so they are chilled in a communal bath of cold water. That way they can come down to temperature very quickly to the internal food safe temperature. And in that process, they pick up some water weight. So it's not as if they're injected with water, but they normally, if you slaughter an animal and chill it in the air or hanging on a hook, it's going to lose moisture and it's going to lose 3 or 5% of its body weight. But if you chill it in water, it actually might pick up 2% of its green weight immediately after slaughter. So you're buying, you know, could be 10% more water than you would in a typical water-chilled bird than you would in an air-chilled bird.
So that would contribute to the mushiness. That would also contribute to purge. Neither of which you have when you're eating an heirloom variety, right? I mean, a heritage variety.
Well, I mean, a heritage variety, if it was water chilled, would also pick up moisture. So I'm not sure if it's the genetics as much as it is the chilling method.
That communal bath has created quite a bit of a problem for the industry, right? Because you know, if you got some bacteria in there and the water's not treated properly, it could definitely be spread much more easily than an air chilled process. Isn't that true?
That's correct. Although there's, you know, chemical interventions as well. You know, the water could be heavily chlorinated or bromides with other disinfectants or, you know, anti-pathogen additions to the bath. And sometimes the air chilled birds are dipped in I guess for lack of a better word, a disinfectant or antimicrobials. They're dipped in that before they begin their air chilling process. So they might come off the line ready to be chilled, and they would be dipped for a moment in to reduce pathogen loads, because salmonella is quite prevalent in chicken and all poultry. And then they'd be dried. So I think the risk of getting cross-contamination is far greater in the water in that communal bath than it is in the air, as you pointed out.
By the same token, we've got a situation where we're eating a little chlorine, bromides, or antiseptic, undoubtedly.
That's correct. And depending on an outfit's willingness to assume risk, the dial gets turned up on the chemicals to prevent a foodborne illness event.
And some of that obviously gets absorbed into the meat also. It's part of the water that's being absorbed.
I could not argue that. I would assume that is exactly the case.
So,
and if not absorbed, it's certainly on the surface if it's not absorbed.
So do you, when you bring your turkeys to slaughter, is there a different process than the typical commercial process? Are there guys that will, you know, cater and are available to cater to a specific and better way of slaughter?
Well, we have been on both sides of that. And as we scaled the company, we were forced, and there are so few options, we were forced ultimately to go to the water chilling on our birds. Prior to that, and where we're right now, we're in the process of rebirthing our turkey operation and poultry and perhaps chickens as well. But we're going to go back to our original, where we killed the birds and air chilled them on racks in a cooler. And it was, I believe it makes a better eating experience, and confident per our discussion that it's a safer product. And in terms of value, if there's a 10% weight gain by water chilling, and what you're buying is 10% extra water, and it's going to purge, you're not going to be able to eat that. So in terms of, you know, the value equation for the consumer, air chill, albeit at first glance, seems much more expensive. But for the amount of meat, edible meat, and digestible nutrients you get, it could be cheaper. I haven't done that calculation, but
okay. So I was very happy that you got to that point, because that was the point I was trying to get to with this whole water bath and the absorption of water, and that 10% number has been the one that I was familiar with. So thank you for getting us there. That's excellent. So what did you feed your turkeys? And by the way, when you talk about we're getting back into it, that's with your relationship with Blue Apron, right?
They exited the turkey business, but my farm is independent of Blue Apron, and so we maintain the breeding flock. And now we have our own breeding flock, and that's really the family jewels, if you will. So we are growing that, and we'll be back in the market strongly in 2019, the holiday market for 2019.
And that's Bill Nyman, independent of anybody else. And what is that brand going to be? What are you going to sell it under? What brand?
I'm not sure yet. You know, we're talking to people. We had people here today are poultry people, and that's in the works.
But you're restricted because of previous sales of using your just the Bill Nyman name itself, right?
That's unclear, but it's probably so. But we're you know, I'm not. Well, Bill Nyman's my name. I can't. There can only be a few restrictions on that. But in terms of BN Ranch, that name probably won't be revived.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what did you feed your turkeys when you were in your prime, and what do you plan to feed these new ones as opposed to what commercial people do?
Yeah. Well, you know, we're driven by GMO free more than anything else, and we think that they're unknown and undiscovered horror stories out there, as well as discovered horror stories and warnings that we got to stop using genetically modified corn and soybean. You know, it's compelling from a spreadsheet to use that, but my test is always if I don't want to eat it myself, I don't want to sell it, and I don't want to feed it to animals, and if I'm not willing to feed it to my children, which is even a higher test, it shouldn't be sold. So we are clearly opposed to, raising animals to be consumed using genetically modified feeds. So fortunately, we had some choices in California in the West, we can feed wheat and barley and sunflower meal and safflower, other crops that are grown, other concentrates that are grown and are excellent feeds. Are not at this time genetically modified. So that's an important thing to us. And I believe that that right now I think there's a battle in the marketplace, and it's early maybe, but it's coming and it's peaking. It'll peak soon. There's a battle between what's more important to the consumer, GMO-free or in poultry, slower growing. So the organic moniker and antibiotic-free, those things are, not as compelling anymore to consumers. And so one, we're responding to because it's the right thing to do, GMO-free and slower-growing humane raising birds. But it's also a compelling part of our story and differentiates us and anybody who's doing that from the madding crowd.
But organic would be GMO-free. But people are not associating GMO-free with organic? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think they're willing to pay a significant premium for GMO-free, and that is a net better to the farmers than the organic premium and the cost of organic inputs.
Okay, because it could be non-GMO, but still not organic, so there could be synthetic pesticides and fertilizers used in the growth of those grains.
That's correct.
Okay. So poultry, aren't they really carnivores at heart, but yet we always see this, fed 100% vegetarian diet. Is that really what they want to eat? Is that grain, or would they really prefer that succulent insect?
Well, I think omnivores better describes them, and they certainly would eat both carrion, any flesh, and any insect that they could ferret out of their environment, and they would thrive on that. The unfortunate situation is where do you get clean meat and bone meal or slaughterhouse waste or blood meal? How could you identify an industrial supply of meat and meat byproducts, animal byproducts, that you could safely feed to any animals? It's just not out there. So the genesis of vegetarian diet was really a marketing gimmick, I think, for people to feel better about the chickens they're eating and that they're not eating meat. But and it really took hold. But the more compelling reason for not using meat byproducts and meat in a poultry ration is it's just the supply is so contaminated. It's all the animals that were condemned and went to rendering and were not fit for human consumption, whether they had, lead poisoning or, they're radioactive from too much antibiotics or beta agonist or whatever, you know.
So, a lot of that stuff ends up in dog food, right?
Well, a lot of it ends up in chicken feed. Actually, right now, it's not that easy to qualify for pet food. It's much easier to qualify for a meat bone meal that could be fed to pigs or chickens. So the standards are lower, I think. You know, there's so much sentimentality around what people feed their pets, and it's either not good marketing or it's not good science and nutrition to feed lower quality meat products to your pets.
So you got two major problems with commercial poultry, but maybe even commercial meat in general, but certainly poultry and pigs, that they get GMO feed and they also get a feed from a waste stream that is oftentimes highly contaminated.
Yes.
Delightful. Yeah. You know, up in Montana, I had somebody that was helping me raise some sheep, goats, and some pigs and chickens and so on. And so I said to him, and every year, especially when winter came along, we would slaughter a fair amount of the chickens and then, you know, repopulate them in the next season. So you go buy eggs and you go buy, or you go buy chicks, just like you did. And they actually ship them even through the mail, I think, on the chicks. But
yeah.
So I said to him, okay, what I'm interested in is having a chick that comes from layers that are fed either only organic grain or only non-GMO grain. We couldn't find anybody.
Yeah.
So there's actually a little bit of a kink in the, in this whole system that you can't find the rootstock, you know, the little chicks. You can't find them that haven't come from a stock that's basically been fed contaminated feed.
Yeah. No, that's been completely industrialized. The grandparent and parent stock, great-grandparents and grandparents are kept in total confinement because those are the family jewels. And then their eggs are hatched and that they become parent stock. And then the parents will lay 300 to 400 eggs over 18-month, two-laying seasons. And those, their offspring are the broilers. Those are the terminal offspring, terminal eggs. So none of those breeders are kept. 99% of the chickens never get outdoors. So that's not a differentiator. But the breeders are kept in really close confinement, often in cages, so that, you know, because the eggs are what you're trying, that's the cash crop. So you want to get every egg you possibly can. So the in capital investment set up to and infrastructure that the bird lays the egg and it goes down a chute and you get them, keep them fertile, they don't get to set on them, you don't begin cell division. So those birds are living the ultimate industrial agriculture.
So there you go.
Yeah, as bad as their offspring have it, you know, they have it worse.
So there you have it, because the whole humane movement is about, you know, the chickens that we eat, and it hasn't come on the radar at all about the whole breeding stock and how they're basically imprisoned their whole lives.
Yeah, well, it may be because, I mean, the large nonprofit, the large organizations focused on animal welfare, you know, concerned Compassion and World Farming or Humane Animal, the big ones, they know, of course, what's going on, and they know they can't change that. And they're just trying to put enhancements and enrichments in the buildings, you know, so they've made a big fight to have windows in the building. Finally, the industry has put a couple windows in the building, so there'll be natural light coming in, which is considered an enrichment, you know. And then they put a bale of straw in or something so that they can jump up on it. 15,000 or 30,000 birds in a building with a few bales of straw and a window, you know, the size of your windshield on your car. those are considered giant steps forward for animal welfare. You know, it's like, come on. So if the public had any idea what's really going on inside these buildings, was able to get inside of them, or even video, I think they would stop eating the stuff. No, it's really scandalous that we can't get in them and see them. You know, all this stuff being done behind closed doors and solid walls. So but that's a whole other subject.
So how were your turkeys raised? Describe their life.
Well, our breeding flock goes outside every day. That's a huge thing. They could roam over 50 or 100 acres if they want to, but they don't. They know where they live, and they have a symbiotic relationship. Well, that's not exactly, it's not pure symbiotic, but we have dogs that live, guardian dogs that the turkeys live with 24/7, and the turkeys know the dogs protect them from predators. And, you know, poultry is quite vulnerable to predators, especially in our geography. And so even so, they go outside. They could fly away if they want to. They can easily fly over the fences. The fences are really designed to keep the dogs in, not the turkeys, because the turkeys can fly up on the roof of the barn or into the trees, and they do. But so they're outside with lots of room, and the turkeys that we raise for meat have unfettered access to the outdoors and tons of area. I mean, acres and acres to move around on. And they take advantage of it. So that in itself is fairly unique, not in a historical sense. I mean, that's the way all turkeys were raised, maybe 50 years ago. And they have take dust baths, and they fly around a bit, and they play, and they're very active. And they're not only healthier because they can be outside, but I believe that the ability to move around and develop muscle tone and collagen leads to a better eating experience, which is really what it's all about.
And are the male turkeys right along with the females?
We do to a point. Turkey breeding is pretty rough on the females. But because turkeys evolved in northern climates, they've been Darwinian selected to only lay eggs in the spring into the summer. And that's because their offspring would not survive if they were hatched in August or September. They wouldn't grow, they wouldn't mature enough to get through the cold winter. Whereas chickens evolved in the tropics, so they lay 300 eggs a year, and they could be born any time of the year. And why I mention this in answer to your question, from August to November, which is the big growth spurt, and when the turkeys may become sexually mature, because the females aren't cycling then, they're not building eggs, the males are not interested in them, so there's no alpha struggles, or there's no males jumping on the females, because they're not driven to breed, it's driven because they're not cycling. There's no estrus happening, or the equivalent of an estrus. So they can run together, but you can't run breeders necessarily together like that, because it's pretty violent, and it's a problem. So we manage the toms with the breeding females, so we don't. So one, we rotate different toms in and out for breeding purposes, and we also give the hens a rest, because the semen from turkeys will last for 10 days in the oviduct. So if they lay an egg or two eggs every 3 days, they don't have to mate that frequently. So in answer to your question, sometimes we sort them because they have different growth rates, and it's a little bit easier to manage, but they don't have to be separated, and they can run together.
So they get a fair amount of insects in their diet too, don't they? Because they're free out there, free ranging, in addition to the grain that you feed them.
That's correct. You know, of course, you put a few thousand turkeys on a few acres. There aren't too many insects that survive too long. They work hard to get every one of them.
So if I was growing insects, you know, top quality insects, and that could be a feed source for you, wouldn't that be something good for the industry if you're an insect grower?
Well, there's a lot of work doing on that. Yeah, especially the larva. Harris is doing that. He was. I'm not sure if he's still doing it. Soldier flies, that he would reproduce them in the. He had a slaughterhouse on his place, and he would take the slaughterhouse waste and use that as a medium to grow flies in. And the larvae, they would feed to chickens.
And who was doing that?
Will Harris at White Oak Farms. He's quite a celebrity farmer in Bluffton, Georgia.
So,
he's an interesting guy. You should have him. You should interview him.
I will. So, Bill, we're not going to get the sheep today. That'll give us an opportunity to talk one more time together, if you don't mind. But
no, I love it. Any opportunity to talk to Harry Blazer is one I want to take.
In terms of the permaculture approach, integrates animals with other agriculture. You know, the modern agriculture will tell you to do just the opposite. But in what way is poultry complementary potentially to a farm or with other animals, other mammals?
Well, of course, if you can gather their manure, which we do because they're inside half the day, and we have a deeply bedded, and we once a year we clean that out and compost it slightly. Poultry manure is a cold manure, can go right on the ground. But we do compost and we spread it before the rains, and it's a phenomenal source of nitrogen, and that's the classic animal rotation, returning nitrogen to the soil. And it's very effective, especially in areas that are nitrogen deficient. So that's an obvious one. The other thing is, in terms of being able to utilize your naturally occurring forage and other plants and insects, and convert that to droppings and spread them on the ground is another one. So it's.
But they're actually quite complementary with beef cattle, for example. So the beef can be there, the chickens can be there. The chickens, pick the insects and larvae and other things out of the dung as they start to mature.
Yeah.
Right?
It's helpful.
That's quite complementary too, right?
Yeah. But the reality is that in terms of natural systems, I think we'd be far better off without these one-stomached creatures, pigs and chickens, because for them to really thrive and to be available for human consumption, they need to be fed concentrated plant. They need to be fed grain, seeds of the plant. And, there's an awful lot of land that's being tilled and disturbed, and what's going on underground, which is so complex and important, from carbon sequestration to making soil and all the regenerative things that we need to focus on, that if you plow and plant land, who grows corn and soybean, even if you do it organically, there's a net loss. And compare that to grazing animals. We should just be eating grass-fed beef and sheep, or any grazing animals, buffalo, if we want to do the best thing for the environment.
So we need billboards that are the exact opposite of the Chick-fil-A ones. We need chickens on there painting "Eat more beef," right?
Exactly. Grass-fed
beef. Cows on,
it's got to be grass-fed beef, though.
Of course.
Yeah. Now, I think one of the tragedies is all the corn, all the monocrop cultures, and which of course, because there's such compelling business, there's such huge businesses that all the research and energy that went into producing GMO, genetically modified plants, was driven by this huge need for corn and soybean, to most, a huge percentage of which is used to feed animals.
Bill, in Europe, when I was over there helping a major chain, they were making a big deal in the UK about how we don't allow GMOs unless you put them on the label, but we don't even really, we frown. Every major chain over there frowned on GMO as an ingredient. But through the back door or the front door, however you want to describe it, huge amounts of GMO feed for animals was coming in. And in fact, there was this time when there was about a 3 or 4 day gap in the non-GMO feed. And that's when the floodgates opened for the GMO feed. You wonder sometimes if that gap was engineered. So,
by Bayer or like Monsanto,
yeah, right. Yeah. By the third Reich.
Exactly.
So antibiotics. Do you use them? If you use them, do you segregate, or do you? If you used it on a turkey or a chicken, would you just say no? We're not. We have to. It has to go somewhere else. What's your policy on that?
Well, specific to our turkeys, with the heritage breeds, one of the compelling things about those breeds is that they're hardy, and if you allow them to room to roam and don't overcrowd them, they rarely have need for therapeutic treatment, antibiotics and antimicrobials. When you do have situations, which we have had, we treat them with antibiotics. And we sell them to the same customers, but not as antibiotic-free. So my philosophy, and I'd never equivocate on that, is that anybody who raises animals should understand the miracle that these things really work, and that when animals are sick, that given a therapeutic treatment of the right antibiotic, they recover, and it's a wonder, and to deny them that would be cruel. Okay. Now, also understanding that I'm a strong advocate for the use of antibiotics to treat animals that are ill. I'm even stronger in my position that you should never use antibiotics to replace good husbandry or prophylactically, because you're worried that they might get sick. So that you prevent things through husbandry, through genetic selection, and the environment you provide them in so that they can thrive.
And would you impose a mandatory waiting period after you've treated a flock with antibiotics?
Yeah, of course. And I'm not talking, the withdrawal periods on the labels are absurdly short, but it's been proven, and you know I'm involved in this in a really deep way for testing devices, it's been proven most antibiotics are metabolized and excreted at different rates, different families of antibiotics. Tetracycline might be different than penicillin and, selenomycin. At any rate, they're at different rates. But after 60 days or 90 days, and we test down to parts per billion, you can't identify or discover any antibiotic residue that from animals that have been treated 60 to 90 days prior to testing. So if they fully metabolize it, I am really supportive based on that and the results that you get by treating animals. And animals will get sick, that I cannot justify antibiotic-free never ever as a marketing ploy, because the consumer has been convinced that that's what they should be supporting.
You know, you also see on chicken labels no hormones used, but that's an FDA policy, right? You can't use hormones in chickens, so that's kind of bull.
That's correct, and there's some historic, the DES scare, the cervical cancer that was a result of women, of chickens, all animals were being fed DES, which was a synthetic estrogen used in the 50s and 60s. And then the young women who were girls who ate that developed a very high rate of cervical cancer at a very young age. So that was the beginning of the discovery of that and the consequent outlawing of it. And so, as you said, the use of hormones is outlawed for good reason in poultry and pigs, and, you know, in single stomach animals, but it's not outlawed in the use of multiple stomach animals, beef cattle, for example.
So the diseases that are famous for going, wiping out, you know, millions and millions of chickens, and sometimes in this country, but oftentimes in Asia, is it much less likely? Is it almost impossible that that type of epidemic would occur if we were raising our chickens and our turkeys the way that you have?
Well, you know, the industry says that the threat from avian influenza, which is the dread disease you're talking about, or Newcastle is another one, that these are diseases that are spread by wild birds. But strangely enough, serious outdoor-raised poultry had less of an incidence than total confined indoor-raised birds of avian influenza. That's what the data shows. Small flocks, backyard flocks, tend to, because there are so many, might yield a different analysis, a different result. But birds that live outside are hardier, and even though they're more likely to be exposed to droppings from wild birds that would spread avian influenza, they also are more resistant, just like the wild birds are resistant to it. Okay. So, and my experience with poultry that's raised, even with our turkeys, we start them indoors so they don't go outside until they're 6 to 8 weeks old. And they tend to develop more intestinal enteritis, illnesses that aren't life-threatening, but are GI tract challenging. And as soon as you let them outside, that goes away. So we found that to be a therapeutic treatment. So rather than reach for the antibiotics, if birds begin to get a little loose, if you will, open up the doors and let them out, even if they're only 6 weeks old. And they quickly let them loose, and they quickly snap back.
So one of the reasons you keep them enclosed is because of aerial predators? Is that a primary reason?
Yeah, and you know, and they need to be kept as much as possible at a constant temperature, so they don't be outside. You know, some days it's windy, some days it's cold. So it's at least, and then they don't get heated up in the sun of the day because they're under noon. Actually, the turkeys, the farm that we raised our turkeys on, which was in the Central Valley, California, where it gets very warm, they would come in the building during the daytime to get out of the sun if they didn't have shade available in the particular area. And they would go outside afternoon, spend all night outside, and then coming to the next morning, they would come in to eat and drink, and then they would go out again. But they, at noontime, when the sun was high and it was hot, they would come in. So the opposite is true. The young birds want to be warm. Poultry wants, they like to be about 100 degrees when they're in the early stages of their life. And so it's easier to maintain a friendly environment for temperature by keeping them enclosed. That's called brooding.
You said brooding?
Yeah, that means the newly hatched chicks or poults is a baby turkey, that you want to try and keep them at 100 degrees for a couple of weeks.
So what do you call, you got the poults, you got the toms, and then what are the female, the adult females
poults
called?
Well, in chickens, you have chicks, which are newly hatched chickens. They could be roosters or hens. A newly hatched turkey is called a poult, P-O-U-L-T, and the males are toms and the females are hens.
We're about out of time, but I just wanted to mention this poultry category is actually quite rich because, I mean, you got ducks, geese, capon, quail, guinea hens, all kinds of stuff. Have you had experience raising any of those other alternatives?
No, but we did work with a slaughterhouse and farm, big farming operation in the valley that was raising and processing all those. So I have some familiarity with them. More than most people do.
And are they likely to be as commercially raised as anything else?
Yes, and they have their own family of diseases and challenges. The ducks are, it's not pretty.
So is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners before we sign off?
Well, I think it's important to try and discover, have access to outdoor raised poultry or preferably pasture raised, but most importantly, that birds that have unfettered access to the outdoors, they have a better life, they're healthier, they taste better, and it's better all around. So whenever possible, to get genuine outdoor raised poultry, which is not easy, but which hopefully will become easier as time goes on. But you should try and support that.
So we're not only calling you the godfather of grass-fed, we're going to start calling you now the poultry pundit. How's that?
I love it. I love it. And I'm excited. I mean, you can't, I'm very passionate about animal food and trying to restore sensible ways of feeding people really wholesome animal foods. You can't do that without being involved in poultry. It's so ubiquitous. It's such an important part of everybody's cuisine that to stick with pigs and cattle because they're more interesting and it's not, you don't have to have 8 billion of them to meet the annual need in the U.S. But again, I want to change things and restore sensible systems for producing animal foods, and chicken has to be a part of that. And therefore, I'm driven at this stage of my life to do that right in the best possible way.
Sounds like a heck of a mission statement.
Yeah, thank you.
I love you.
You too.
I love you, buddy.
Look forward to talking sheep.
Thanks.
And counting them. Bye-bye.
See you, buddy. Thank you.